grab your highlighters. Can't find them? They're probably right there in your pocket protector. It's time for that Early Childhood Nerd Podcast. Let's get nerdy. Here's Heather.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of That Early Childhood Nerd. I'm Heather Burnt Santee, and on this episode, I've got Liz Nolasco joining me. Nolasco.
Hello.
I've only been saying your name on air for 7 years. You know, I should have it by now, however long it's been.
To be fair, it changed midway through.
That's true. Anyway, Liz Nolasco is here, which is fun, except I was thinking about this beforehand. I don't know that I ever record with you where I feel like anything, but God, she's so smart. And I was also there. So no pressure, but every now and again.
Glad one of us thinks I sound competent here.
Anyway, so we're going to talk about stuff from an article. The article is called Introduction to the Special Issue.
We didn't want to marathon this and do the entire special
issue. Yeah. So it's a special issue of a journal called Early Education and Development. And if you haven't read this kind of introduction kind of thing before, essentially they just talk about what all the articles are going to say. But every now and again, the introduction itself also has like important key kinds of things to think about in it. So so that's what this is. And the authors are Beth Blue Swadner and Shirley Kessler. And of note, the article is from 1991, which will become relevant as we talk, as we go. I just used in class this week, I know I just re-released the podcast during one of the weeks when I was sick and couldn't record, but the article Patience versus Understanding, which is from Young Children, NACI's journal from like 1987. And it's much like this. It's like, seriously, have we still not got this figured out? Okay, so let me do this quote that you shared as the starting point. It says, of significance among reconceptualist perspectives is the social, historical, and political context of the early childhood curriculum. Underlying this rethinking of curriculum planning is the study of the relationship between what we teach in school and the unequal outcomes of schooling based on social class, race, language, or dialect, and gender. According to this perspective, schools are not seen as the equalizer in society, as Horace Mann envisioned, but as a means of reproducing the race, class, and gender inequities which persist in society today. That's a heavy one to start with.
Sorry, I didn't realize like what a tongue twister I was sending you when I sent it in my head and didn't have to read it out loud.
Like I did like a little kind of giggle, and it's not because of the content, it's because I was really struggling to get all the words right. Anyway, so will you talk a little bit about why this was the article you sent, why this is the quote you chose, and then we'll go from there.
So I am reading this from California, where there's been a big push for universal pre-K, universal early childhood. So transitional kindergarten has become a grade in the public schools, which is for children who are going to turn 5 within the school year. So they've turned 5 by, I think May is the last deadline, basically. Mm-hmm. So it puts the vast majority of 4-year-olds into public school, or at least they have the option of public schooling. And the argument for this has been, we need to get the children ready because, you know, it all comes back to that kindergarten readiness argument.
Yeah.
With an extra special lens of, well, we have all these kids who aren't meeting requirements, and so we need to get them earlier when they're younger, they have all this growth potential that we're not addressing, except they seem to be viewing that growth potential as just the potential to fit in with hegemonic expectation rather than to grow as people and citizens. It's teaching them to play the game, and yet still not letting them play the game.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people who are listening to the show know our position about school readiness and early academics and all the concerns we have about that. And I think we try to so often use the argument that Well, we want them to have their full childhood. We want them to have these full, rich experiences. We want them to, you know, have time to develop. But the system doesn't want that. I mean, that's what this really is about, is that that's exactly why we're talking about starting them so early and earlier in public school, so that we can just turn them into the kind of public school student we want and not worry about the individuals that they could be. Like, we talk about their potential, but we don't mean their individual potential. We mean their potential to be what we want them to be and to fit into the system.
Right. And I was really digging into this idea of what schools could be if they were an equalizer in society.
Yeah.
Right. Because I think there's a bad, to be clear, but there's an argument to be made that having that, the cultural currency, right, of being able to interact in these primarily white institutions, these mm-hmm. have been created and upheld by white supremacy and the patriarchy, mm-hmm. is still a skill, right? Mm-hmm. And people who are good at that will climb the ranks. I think that's a bad argument. I think the fact that patriarchy and white supremacy is a pretty good indicator that they should be back down and rebuilt anyway. But there is this idea that playing the game, right? I keep going back to this metaphor, sorry.
Yeah.
Is the goal, right? You want mm-hmm. to just keep climbing, and no matter what that means for you as a person, no matter what that means, even in the broader society, success is that rags to riches story, mm-hmm. right? We love the American dream, mm-hmm. but we don't allow it to be meaningful in a group, in a collective context.
Right. But there, yeah, so we're very much in favor of the American dream, but it's one specific American dream, right? It's not,
right,
it's
right.
not, we're supportive of everyone pursuing and achieving their dream. And that's our goal. It's, here's the definition we've given. And it's usually a right. very white, male dominated kind of an American dream definition.
And it's not about it's not about ending the rags to riches story, right? It's mm-hmm. not about saying this is a land of plenty and therefore we're all doing okay, right? Yeah. Like, baseline is just fine. But it's, again, this capitalistic, competitive, hyper-individualistic culture of each person needs to keep outdoing themselves and keep mm-hmm. competing and beating others down.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if school were able to act as an equalizer, if there was some way in which a large structural institution could serve this, mm-hmm. you know, and I keep going back to like, what could this look like? What would this look like?
Yeah.
What does it mean? Because I'm stuck, right?
Yeah.
I'm turning over my head of like, there is so much use for scholars. There's, you know, we need people to study and to know things and to hold these histories and research and these records. And we also need people who are able to do our day-to-day tasks. And ideally, in a perfect mm-hmm. world, we can do these day-to-day tasks for ourselves as well, instead of mm-hmm. being fully enslaved to whoever's giving us money.
Yes. Yeah. So what, will you talk about how you interpret that idea of school being an equalizer? Please. Sorry. I was going to then talk about my definition, but I think that would be rude to ask you and then say, because here's what I think. So go ahead.
No, I'm excited to hear yours. No, and so that's where I'm stuck, right? I think the idea of school's equalizer is offering opportunities, right? Mm-hmm. It's being able to, if this is a thing that you are seeking and would like to do and have interest in doing, having the opportunity to study. And I do think that an education is a basic human right. I think that being educated within one's culture, within the knowledge of one's society, is a basic human right and could be an equalizing factor mm-hmm. if it were designed to be so, mm-hmm. be such a thing.
Yeah. So I just, I think that school, I want to make a distinction between school as a potential to be an individualizer is the word I was going to say, an equalizer, and school to be a standardizer are two different things, right? I think the way it plays yes. out is they're just really looking for everyone to be a standard human, and not necessarily a fulfilled human, if that makes sense. And I think if we're talking about equalizing, then we have to bring in stuff like not just academic achievement, right? Not just, you know, whatever somebody else's definition of good employment is, or there has to be an element of just being, like a human being who's had an opportunity to flesh themselves out and learn about themselves and what they want to contribute and what, how they fit. You know what I mean? It has to be broader than just, we think that if we can get everyone to get this score on a standardized test, then we have done our job of providing equality to the world or to the masses.
Right. Like college graduation is not the top of Maslow's pyramid, right?
Yeah. Right. Yes.
It's a little bit bigger than that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's such a small part of the pyramid. I mean, if we're talking about what is at the top of Maslow's hierarchy, mm-hmm. you know, everything else is so much bigger and so much greater. But we start with that, the top of the pyramid in mind. And that's the framework we have for the whole thing is that,
right.
And we're all defining the top of the pyramid for ourselves too, depending on, sure. on our needs, I think. So
this is where educators get burned out because they see all the things below that the children yeah. are coming without and are trying to address them and just do not have the bandwidth or the capacity yeah. because we don't care about children, we care about test scores.
Right. Yeah. Because, and even if we really did globally, not you and me, even if we really did have a concern that we wanted every child to be successful, that we wanted every child to get that test score, not because we're judged by the test score, but because we think that there's some greater good that comes to them because they achieve that. Then if that was really our belief that could happen, then we would be paying more attention to stuff like poverty and family wellness and not just what else can I load onto this 3-year-old's shoulders so that we can achieve our idea of an educated, successful population.
Right. And how can we achieve these things proactively instead of
yes.
in response, right? I feel yeah. like so much of the ACEs conversation, to bring it in a totally different direction,
yeah.
is a frantic response to the known traumas that are happening, mm-hmm. both, you know, on an individual level and a cultural level. And there's no framework or no wide adaptation of framework that would prevent instead of react to.
Right. Right. I just recorded an episode with Stephanie Galloway, who has written a book about resilience using fairy tales as kind of a structure for the conversation in her book. But we talked about this, and we talked about shifting from thinking about being trauma responsive to being trauma informed, where it's trauma responsive, we're waiting to see the trauma or the effects of the trauma, right. and then we'll do something about it. But if we're trauma informed, do we just know that some of the children coming to us are going to have this experience and some of their families are going to be having stressful, toxic kinds of experiences. And we have to just have practices in place that acknowledge that reality for everyone instead of waiting for the child to show us that there's been something traumatic. And, you know, I think that's, if we're talking about policy and public education, that's probably a little bit too socialist for right. a lot of people, even though public education essentially is a socialist endeavor.
Yeah, I mean, if you propose it today.
Right, yeah.
And I think even on top of that, it seems to fall outside the scope of schooling, right? I mean, how are we yeah. defining schooling? Mm-hmm. Is it specifically academic pursuits? Is mm-hmm. it, is there a point at which it changes from broader to narrower? I mean, it feels like, I think a lot of early childhood people say, well, yeah, you know, in early childhood, it's all connected, the social, emotional, the academic, the physical, and then they kind of separate the head from the hands, right? Mm-hmm. getting Waldorf here. Sorry.
I was going to say, that was Malaguzzi. I was going to say, getting a little Malaguzzi in here.
Malaguzzi, right. Sorry. Waldorf does have the 4-H's though.
Yeah.
Ooh, that was embarrassing. So
no. We can throw Bev Boz in there too. She has... Throw 4-H in. Let's get all the H, the hearts and hands organizations in.
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, no, you're good. But, you know, at what point do we do this? Do we have to do this? Is it necessary to do this? Yeah. What makes schooling schooling, you know? And but then there's a continuum. There's a...
Yeah.
There's a point at which bestowing knowledge upon children is argued, right? There's a very strong argument, particularly in early childhood, that children and like all learners should be constructing their own knowledge, right? Mm-hmm.
Right.
And finding that interaction, finding that point at which the adult is in fact a valued piece of that interaction, right? To present that scaffolding, to create the opportunities, mm-hmm. versus letting the child fully create their own, which they're not equipped to do. Finding, mm-hmm. I guess, the role of the adult, the educator, whatever you are in this equation.
Yeah.
And building that framework together with the child and children. Mm-hmm. I guess where I was going in my head that I didn't get out loud was a raw, you know, the many and much argued facets of homeschooling, right? And home, uh-huh. education and unschooling, all those different ideas that we could all argue about sort of blue in the face, but mm-hmm. require adult involvement and participation. Mm-hmm. The same way traditional schooling requires adult involvement and participation, and what that looks like, what that could look like, what that should look like, and what most benefits the child is still so wide and broad that I don't feel comfortable making any kind of broad declarations in any way.
Right. Yeah.
They'll just, I guess, sorry, to bring kind of back to the idea of school, like how school could be an equalizer, right? And just finding that balance of children's perspectives, children's internal resources and the way they make sense of the world with that guidance. And maybe it's the guidance that's missing, right? Maybe it's this vision of schooling as guidance towards helping a person accomplish whatever it is they have set out to do that day, that week, that year, right? Mm-hmm. But again, it's a lot harder to standardize.
Right. And that's the problem, is so much of what you and I are talking about and the other kinds of curriculum models that the article talked about is hard to measure and isn't necessarily valued enough to find a way to make sure it's happening, and to think about, you know, if we do have to measure it, how could that be done? It just, you know, we've just really settled on this linear model, and we're not happy with learning being linear. Now we think we can, you know, accelerate that linearity.
Right. But right. The earlier is better.
And, right. Yeah. Like dragging the bar to make it happen, you know, to get to that spot faster. And it's, I don't know. It just really, sometimes when if I really stop and think about it, you know, this article was 1991. We haven't really made a whole lot of progress. In fact, we've probably gone backwards some in this idea of how do we truly understand how children learn? And is it possible for us then to allow them to learn in that way in the current system?
Right. And I guess to keep it in the realm of early childhood, right? Because so many of our schooling memories are from much older, much later in childhood and adolescence, right? But to keep it in early childhood, to keep the idea of the early childhood setting as an equalizer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm going two ways, right? Because on one hand, I'm saying you can't just introduce them earlier and hope that that gives them a leg up because you're pushing it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, also three is kind of too late if you're actually looking to make a substantial right. impact on families.
Right, right. two different methods to make the impact in, you know, I mean, two different ways of thinking. Two, we're battling the reality of sort of brain development and the myth of the banking method of education, where we just pour stuff into empty heads or empty banks or bank accounts. I mixed my metaphors. Sorry, Paolo. So I just finished reading this book. It's pretty brand new. I think Casey Stockstill is the author, and it's called False Starts. And the subtitle is something about the segregated lives of preschools. And she spent several years following a Head Start classroom and a like private preschool classroom. And a lot of it, it's still very fresh. And I don't want to try to summarize the whole thing, but a lot of what she said early is this idea that, using Head Start as the example, because that's one of the classrooms she was doing her research in, their sort of Head Start's founding purpose was to address poverty and to sort of level that playing field. And now we hear more about achievement gap kinds of, you know, children of color or children in poverty are more at risk to not do the school stuff we want them to by the time we want them to do it. And so we put them all in one program together, not thinking about the fact that just the stressors of poverty and the stressors of, facing families of color increase the amount of trauma kinds of behaviors and things that you see. And so they can't really get to the learning enriching kinds of things they promise, the academic gains they promise, because they're so busy just dealing with the trauma of putting them all in one space together. And then the other preschool class, she just didn't, like, they had so many more opportunities. They read, like, one of the things she talks about is how many more just books they share with each other, not necessarily reading time in a group, but stories they get to read to each other and to the children in the private preschool, because they aren't having the disruptions that traumatic living causes.
Right.
In that concentration that they're seeing it in the Head Start classroom, it was really eye-opening. It was really a different way of thinking about this idea of trying to be equalizers as part of the education system.
Right. And I think there's so much there. And then there are these institutions that arise that claim to be purposefully making a difference, right? They're targeted to these underserved populations with the goal of saying, look, we are going to address these gaps. Mm-hmm. And all they do is eliminate externalizing behaviors through like behavior modification programs.
Right.
So yeah. They're doing all this rote learning that we know is not as beneficial for their brain as experiencing and experimenting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they're, you know, trained out of these behaviors or kicked out of the program.
Yeah.
And so they don't get that full and rich lived experience that their more affluent peers are allowed to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, which brings us back to this conflict of it needs to start at birth, and also it needs to, right? It just can't, there's too much and not enough. And maybe it's just that we're looking at the wrong things.
Right. Well, and I think we're each trying to pour different things in.
Right.
Those of
us,
you know, but so, you said something earlier about families too, and with the transitional kindergarten and universal pre-K, one of the ideas that you hear is, well, it helps parents learn how to be like school parents too. So part of it is also what I've seen anyway, many times. Not only do we need the children in there earlier so that we can train them into the system earlier, where, you know, we call it family engagement or whatever, but what we're really doing is teaching families to like not have their kids miss school and get there on time and do what the school asks you to do, and which completely I think contributes to this idea of, you know, whatever Horace Mann's idea was of reproducing the disparities, because we completely then erase their family culture and their, you know, ability to see themselves as competent parents or to develop competencies or to be celebrated for the things they already have as strengths. And we're just trying to
the parents who are dealing with their own school traumas.
Yes, exactly. We're just trying to homogenize the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, I mean, it's, and again, that idea, the family engagement idea is so very biased towards the families that have the time and funding to spend all this extra time.
Right. The time and the funding and the mobility and the kind of emotional safety and all of that stuff is, has to be taken into consideration when we're talking about, you know, this whole, the whole idea of getting families ready for school. It's, it's all very one-sided.
Right. And I have to say, I haven't heard as much about that in a lot of the DK expansion stuff, but I'm sure there is an element of it there.
Yeah. And I kind of started with TK and slipped into general universal preschool and some Head Start conversations that I've been part of locally. Yeah.
Right.
I would have been a horrible, you know, in those, they would have been so frustrated with me and they would have totally been thinking I was a disengaged parent, but, you know, that would not have been accurate. I just wasn't engaging in the way they were wanting me to engage.
Right. Right. And it's, you know, again, this balancing act of modern family life in the United States when the majority of families need two working parents, and when are you going to have time to work an 8-hour shift and commute and also stop by and volunteer at the bake sale and also go to, you know, it's not that parents should be disconnected from school, but there have to be ways to meet in the middle. There have to be ways for families to understand what their children are learning and be, you know, understand what's going on in their classroom. Certainly, and I, in a perfect world, have time with their kids, because God knows we have, what, 3 a week hours with them each night, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I used to get a lot of criticism because my kids didn't necessarily have bedtime. But it was because we'd get home at like 6 and then we'd have dinner. And then if it was bath night, you know, it was like, I wanted to be their mom for a while. So we'd stay up a little longer. So it's, you know, they're just, we have to lose this idea of there's only one way to be an engaged parent, or only one way to be a successful school student, or to be a teachers too. I want, you know, this is a systemic problem. This isn't evil teachers. There may be some of them out there, but most of the time it's just the system creates. Kisa Marx and I were talking the other day, and she said something about, you know, the teachers feel oppressed by the system, and then they push that down on the only people they have kind of within their reach to push down on. And if we're not really intentional and aware of what's going on, we fall into that as teachers.
Right. And I think there's such an interesting dynamic there, right? Because teachers are, at the elementary level, at least, are judged on their children's test scores. Right. In early childhood, there's less of that. I know when I was a Head Start teacher, I wasn't being evaluated based on like the teaching strategies gold or anything like that.
But yeah, I think some are. I mean, I do think some are.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm sure it exists. That was not my personal experience.
Right.
But it is self-perpetuating, and there are these accidental incentives to, you know, direct the resources to the kids who are going to pass, right? Ignore the kid, to write kids off. There's an incentive to write kids off because it's such a narrow definition of success.
Right.
Instead of being there for every child, it's being there for the ones who respond the right way. And, you know, this is what I feel like I'm teaching, not when I'm dealing with behaviors, right?
Yeah.
And so, and when it starts that early, it's you know, these kids are feeling disenfranchised by the time they get to the public schools.
And right. They've already learned that they're
by first or second grade.
Yeah. They've already learned that they're not good at school before they're officially in school. already learned that the teacher is an adversary or a stressor in their life. You know, we talk an awful lot about trauma at home. We don't talk a lot about the trauma that we cause sometimes in our early childhood classrooms.
There's so much, I mean, especially when they're so little, there's no reason for them not to be afraid of adults. And I feel like we don't always spend as much time as we need to making ourselves unscary for them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
In a basic physical way.
So if you ran the show, Liz, how do we do early childhood in a way that's an equalizer and not a reproducer?
See, and this is where I'm stuck. So I want to talk to you about it because I have no answers.
Yeah, but... that's why I'm asking you. I mean, I think, you know, there's some of the obvious stuff, like learning more about what that the first 3 years are so important really means, and the value of early childhood really means, and really digging in when we hear phrases like, well, the research shows that high quality early childhood leads to all these great results as an adult. What were those programs that were being researched really doing? It wasn't longer circle times and teaching strategies gold. It was, you know, those programs were very different. But for me, I just need to learn more. Like, as I was reading this, it's another reminder that it's easy for me to say, you know, that our early childhood programs, a lot of our definitions of quality tend to be white normative, but it's hard for me to explain what that really means sometimes. And if we are like, I'm white, I'm the norm, you know, I'm the normative.
Right.
So if I don't know about other, you know, other groups of human beings, then I don't have anything to compare it to. And I can't see, oh, that's what you're talking about. So that, for me, that's one of the things for me, if I want this to be an equalizing opportunity, then I have to do the work on my part to learn.
Right.
What would help it to be, you know, what would lead us that direction?
Right. And I guess going back to the quote, right, the relationship between what we teach in school and the unequal outcomes of schooling, I feel like the verb teach is doing a whole lot in that phrase, right? Because it is, you know, even in the most broad interpretation, there's still this idea of that pouring into, like you were talking about, right?
Yeah.
And like you were just saying, right, understanding the ways these different identities intersect within each person who is present at the school in the schooling,
right,
is crucial at first. And then, and again, just supporting the families, like supporting the whole family, you know, helping families understand why what we're doing at school is important, and also making sure that what we're doing at school is important and beneficial.
I was just going to say,
yeah. Like to underline real hard.
Yeah, there. Yeah. Or, you know, giving every family a chance somehow to tell us what's important for them and their child. You know, and I'm not saying the whole, you know, the customer's always right. I'm not talking about, well, my family culture is to bite when they bite you. That's not what I'm talking about. because I just ranted not too long ago about when we say the parent, but the parents want it, you know, that doesn't mean you have to. Anyway, but giving them some kind of real engagement, like not here's our family night and here's our parent group and here's when I need you here for parent conferences. And when I tell you something happened, I expect you to do something. That's not really engaging. That's pretty top down. When there shouldn't be a top, it should be a pretty horizontal relationship. But giving them ways to really be engaged, and you don't do that unless you know. So it starts with the people in front of us, I guess, is where I'm trying to go with that. Like, I can read the books and I can listen to the podcasts and, you know, but I also need to pay attention to the people in front of me.
No, exactly. And it's made all the more difficult by a broader society outside of the schools that has no incentive to change these power structures.
Right. And a pretty strong incentive to keep them, like not just not just being sort of neutral, because I guess there is no neutral, but yeah, if it benefits me, I'm not gonna put a whole lot of work into figuring out other ways of doing things.
Right. Well, that was a cheery way to finish this.
It was. I was like, wait, where do we go from here? Because that was a real bummer.
I mean, I think it's
I don't
kind
know.
of
There's work
inspiring
to be
to
done,
think
I
about,
guess,
like,
again.
right. And I feel like the idea of there's work to be done is kind of an uplifting, like, you know, there are ways to fix this.
Yeah,
It
I
can be
think,
done.
yeah, I don't have the, you know, I don't have the quote and completely in my head. And I think it's from the anti-bias education book, Louise Derman Sparks. And there's a co-author on that I can't remember, a couple of them. But I just remember really there being very early in the book, something about the deep hopefulness of the work. The deep hopefulness of feeling like a difference can be made, and that a future world could be created by the work we're doing right now with children and families.
Yes, love it.
Yeah, so maybe that's where we can end and think about deep hopefulness.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Well, thanks, Liz.
Thank you.
We're not really
and
going
there
to
is
work.
demand for this entire
I was just going to say, we're not really working through all 8 articles of the special issue, are we? But we could.
We
sure
could.
We can make it a series. Yeah. I'll just need to bring in a third nerd so that when I don't have anything smart to say, you two can carry on and I can just kind of hang out in the background. All right. Well, thank you, Liz. This was very challenging and fun. To think in these kind of ways that the article you sent me made me do. Anyway, now this is the part of the episode where I don't know how to end it. So let's just say thank you very much, everyone, for listening to another episode of That Early Childhood Nerd. And please come back again for another episode. Bye.
Bye.
And that's the show. Now go get your nerd on.
Has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.